today is a special episode. We're doing a roundtable discussion all about the current Save the Arts campaign happening at the U of W, and we're going to further on and intermingled with that discussion talk about sort of larger student movements and just sort of maybe larger social movements in general. So with me today are two current students, Rack and John, and Bronwyn, who is a contract faculty in the Department of Sociology, which is one of the departments that's been hardest, or that will be hardest hit by the cuts that have been announced. So to start off, whoever would like to go first, how about you explain just what exactly this Save the Arts campaign is about and why the arts need saving?
All right. Yeah, basically it's a protest of the proposed budget cuts to programs like sociology and German. Basically, we are looking to make sure that the the positions that are on schedule to be cut are renewed. That's our primary focus right now. So that's what our most of our action has been centered around.
Okay, so what would these cuts mean for the arts?
Well, again, for sociology in particular, there would be 12 courses that wouldn't be taught next year. So that's, and those are a lot of specialized courses too, so for a lot of second and third year students, they'd have a really tough time finishing their sociology degree, and at least, like, they wouldn't be able to take it in the stream that they're looking forward to. And for German, that would mean it's, the program is basically defunct as one of the two.
So courses like, what are some of the courses that have been cut?
Sociology and medicine.
Immigration.
Family.
Pretty basic things.
Yeah.
I think you sort of touched on it a little bit, but what are the specific demands of the campaign to what would you guys want out of your campaign to happen in the Department of the Arts?
Well, first and foremost, just that the positions that are scheduled to be cut, that we retain the positions, the existing positions. That's our primary focus right now.
Our immediate goal is to have the current courses maintained for next year and have our faculty maintain the sociology department as well as in the other programs that are being affected for next year.
So there's, is just to give some details, there's, correct me if I'm wrong, there were three sessional faculty who were up for tenure. Is that what it was?
Yeah, I believe so.
And and their positions, they've been denied tenure and effectively let go, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing I would like maybe you, Bronwyn, to explain, because as a professor, you probably have good insight into this.
Well, I'm not a professor. Well, I'm a contract faculty. But therein lies the important distinction.
Yeah. So even I, who am a grad from the U of W, I really don't understand, you know, what does tenure track mean and and all those terms. Could you maybe give us a brief rundown of that? Because a lot of those terms are being thrown around in relation to this campaign.
And they use different terms everywhere, so it's a little bit confusing. And a lot of students, when they're in their undergrad, are not aware that there's all of these different gradations of instructors. But the model for universities has been increasingly a shift to contract faculty away from tenured positions. So if you have a tenured position, I think you're able to, you have a certain amount of job security, so you're able to talk and do research that's controversial and not be at risk of being let go. And you get paid more, so you have more time to put into teaching. At the U of W, I believe sessionals are below tenured faculty, but well above contract faculty. They don't have the same job security, but they get paid more. Contract faculty are paid really badly. Like, the amount of work that I do works out to less than minimum wage to teach a university course. And so obviously I don't have the time to put into it that other professors do, nor do I have the expertise of somebody with a PhD. I have a master's degree, but students benefit from having professors with PhDs. So this shift toward cutting tenured positions and cutting massive amounts of courses has been made up in other places with contract faculty, and that's definitely bad for students.
So is that part of the campaign as well, sort of fighting for more tenured professors, or is that sort of incidentally attached because you're fighting for, you know, not, some professors not to be fired?
Well, it's not fired. It's just cut, because they would have to be hired onto a tenure stream after, because they can only be hired, I think, on three, what is it, sessional contracts? And then after that, they become tenure streams. So then what the university...
As per the collective agreement.
Yeah. So then what they're doing is just cutting them at that point, and then they would replace, if they would replace them, it would be with sessionals or contract faculty.
And although we would like to address these long-term concerns, our immediate goal is to have these positions maintained for next year.
But there was discussion at one of the meetings about, like, there's awareness among the students who are organizing that it is better to have professors rather than just sessional faculty. Or rather than just contract faculty, right? So there has been an acknowledgement of the fact that these exact positions that have been terminated are the ones they want back, not contract faculty.
Now I'm going to read off to you guys some of the arguments that I've seen against the campaign, because it sounds you guys are presenting it very simplistically, maybe just, you know, for the sake of time or you know, what you can rattle off the top of your head. But I think this will be a way to sort of explain the nuances a bit. So people are saying that the money, that in fact there's no cuts being made because there's no net loss of professors, because professors from those departments that are being cut, are those positions are basically moving to other departments. And that shift is taking place because there's more students in those departments, and therefore it's sort of more profitable. And that's a good thing for the university, because profitability means maybe lower tuition and those kind of things. So so there's going to be no German department. Well, who cares about German anyways, right? well, that's the argument that's being made. So how would you guys respond to that sort of argument?
Well, let's not forget that Intro to Sociology has one of the highest enrollment rates at the University of Winnipeg. I mean, I think we're only next to Intro to Psych or those courses that... It's not that there isn't an interest in sociology. There's a huge interest, and the numbers are there. I think it's just a part of the administration, you know, drastically trying to reduce the number of faculty.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note too that over the past 4 years, there's been 9 professors in the sociology department that have retired, and none of those positions have been replaced. None of those tenure positions have been replaced. So basically the department has sort of naturally just been gutted, and all that money has sort of left the department, but we're not rehiring. So then our concern with the 3 professors not being moved to tenure stream after their sessional years is even greater, because sociology itself is really facing like a pretty big problem there.
So of course if there's, you know, 9 professors who've retired who've positions haven't been replaced, course offerings have already been scaled back, of course perhaps fewer people are going to be choosing sociology because there's less options. But also it's really problematic to model a university on that consumer choice standard, you know, as if, as you say, just because a lot of people aren't signing up for German, we shouldn't have German. Like, what if a lot of people stopped signing up for history at whatever point? Like, do we cut history out of the university? Like, these things should sound absolutely ridiculous, but somehow people have accepted the packaging of the issue, which is that because there's not demand, we should cut supply. And that's really distorted, I think.
If there is all this demand, and that's sort of a false pretense of an argument, that sociology is actually popular and lots of students go there, so they should have the professors. So I can't ask you guys to like read the minds of the faculty, but what is their rationale? Why are they doing these things that seem
of the faculty or
absurd,
the administration?
Or the administration, rather.
Okay. I'm not really sure. I think it was sort of coincidental with all the professors retiring. And yeah, I couldn't honestly tell you. I think that there may be a disconnect there, that they're not really even aware of which positions that they're cutting. So it just happened that 3 professors were scheduled to go tenure, and they decided, because once you go tenure, you're also teaching less classes, as well as you're being paid more. So fiscally, I guess it would make more sense to them to hire somebody who's going to teach twice as many courses, but who they only have to pay a fraction of the price. But really then the students are the ones who suffer. Mm-hmm. They're not offered the same amount of courses, the same quality. They don't get to have the same relationships with their professors because they'll just leave after their 3 years, and then, you know, there's no relationship there anymore.
Also, just to speak again to the crappiness of the contract faculty thing and of these cuts that are happening, like Intro to Sociology classes will necessarily get bigger. I have 60 students in my class right now. In each of my classes, 60 students each. The maximum enrollment was 90. I could have had 90. There's no way like, I don't even know everybody's name. There's no way I can offer valuable comments on their work. I can't respond to their specific needs. Like, the value that the U of W has had for so long is this small undergraduate institution where you know your professors. Like, I went to McGill for my undergrad and had a much worse undergraduate education than my friends who went to the U of W, for sure. But our administration would like to move us in the direction of those larger universities.
Yeah, it's really interesting that they foist the most amount of students in a class, and students who are making their who are getting their first impression of university experience on the least experienced professors. A lot of irrationality, it seems, going on in the administration. All right, so the next sort of argument that's being made is, well, the argument that you guys are making is that I've seen in some places that they shouldn't be expanding with all these buildings and, you know, buying the Bay potentially in the future and a soccer complex and things like that, because that's money that could go otherwise towards professors' salaries. And the response from the administration has been, there's two separate budgets. There's budgets for buildings, and there's budgets for professors, and they do fundraising for buildings, and that's easier to do. They can get government grants for new projects like that, but they can't get the same funding from the government or from donors as they can for professor salaries. So how would you respond to that argument?
All the capital budget is separate from the operating budget. The university chooses to fundraise exclusively for the capital budget. That argument on behalf of the administration, in my opinion, is very political. I mean, I'm sure they understand that when you build a new building, you have to staff it with more people. And those security guards, maintenance workers, whatever else you're going to need, I mean, where is that going to come from? The operating budget, of course. So the rationale that these two are completely different and that the fact that we're building all these new buildings has absolutely no impact on the operating budget is completely false. And it dances around the issue of, you know, sort of where are what are the intentions of the administration? Sort of what are their
priorities,
and what are the students' priorities? Unfortunately, at this point, in my opinion, it doesn't seem like they're on the same page.
Mm-hmm. All right, and so what about the argument? I think this was made by Axworthy himself, or one of his sort of toadies, that the U of W gets so much less government funding per student than the U of M and the University of Brandon, that the stats are that the U of M and Brandon get about $12,000 per student and the U of W gets only $6,500 per student, and that this differential is the reason why they can't hire more tenure track professors or keep the, you know, keep professors and move them into tenure as they would otherwise.
Well, for the U of M, for example, they have faculty of medicine, of engineering, all these faculties that the U of W doesn't have, and that costs a lot more to operate and to staff, and like for all their equipment and everything. So these programs cost a lot more, so the government has to pay. Like maybe twice the amount isn't necessarily right, and I'm sure there's problems with that, but that the argument that we should be getting just as much or that it's the government's fault because we're only getting half, I mean, it's seriously flawed because they're two completely different schools with different programs. So that's just too simplistic of an argument to make.
And at the same time, I'd like to add that the province is not decreasing its funding. I mean, it's the same amount of money that we were getting last year, and it's enough money to just maintain what we have at this level, and that's essentially what we are arguing for right now, is to maintain that same level. So it would be, I could see that argument making sense if the province was saying, hey, we're going to give you even less money, but that's not the case. They're giving us the same amount of money that we got last year, and Axworthy and the administration knew how much money they were going to get. Mm-hmm.
I mean, absolutely, the province should be funding all universities more. Our tuition should be decreasing, not increasing over time. It should be zero, you know, but also that's a really easy way for Lloyd Axworthy to deflect criticism from the fact that it's his priorities. Like, he doesn't have his priorities straight. He's building buildings.
Yeah, and going back to the argument that it's easier to fundraise for buildings, like that, in my opinion, that's kind of silly. Like, even if it is, then is that reason to just not fundraise for professors? that doesn't add up to me. Just because you can get more for buildings, so now we're just not going to fundraise for faculty. I don't see the logic in that.
Also, the fundraising for buildings is to a much more significant degree in the private sphere, and that should be of concern to us as well. Like, the fact that there's all of this capital expenditure. A lot of the money's coming from the private sector. Like, that's also part of the restructuring of the university.
I'm going to pick up on something provocative you said, Bronwyn, about no tuition. Mm. Oh, my goodness. So,
I mean, that's my personal opinion.
Yeah,
that's not the struggle on the table right now.
But. Sure, but the arguments are made that, well, I mean, we could hire so many more professors if we just, like, doubled or tripled the tuition, and, like, that's what we're doing mm-hmm. in Quebec, and it's, you know, it's working out great there. if we raise tuition, then we could offer better quality education, we could hire more professors, and...
To fewer students.
But wouldn't the quality of staff, like, just attract so many more students than would otherwise be here?
No.
Not if anybody can't afford it.
Yeah.
No.
And also, it simply hasn't been the case that when tuition has been raised, that money has gone to professors' salaries or more professors or expanding programs. Like, that just isn't what happens.
Maybe it wouldn't be an issue if we didn't have so much income inequality in society in general. Mm-hmm. If, you know, if we didn't have such a, you know, polarized, group of people income-wise, that everybody, perhaps if it was more expensive and everybody did have the means to afford it. But unfortunately, that's not the case. We do have... a very polarized population, and we do have people who can't afford an education. And if it was higher, I mean, I don't think that's fair to a lot of students, you know, especially here at the university right now.
I asked my students what they would do if tuition were raised by a grand next year, let's say. In Quebec, I guess the proposed increase is doubled tuition over 5 years, but of course their tuition is lower anyway. Anyway.
A 75% increase.
Okay.
Is over 5 years, yeah.
About... like, most of the students in my class said that they wouldn't be able to afford university. So I think in the UK, recent cuts have caused tuition to increase, and they, like, 23,000 students who were planning on coming, like, this isn't just a projection, this is students who were going to attend university could no longer attend. So.
So it does have a drastic effect.
Right.
And not a good one. All right, so... getting back to the campaign itself, and I think you guys did a pretty good job responding to those arguments, and I hope it came across that I was being incredibly facetious in my asking of them. How is the coalition of people who are working on this issue? Because I know that the Faculty Association has made statements sort of in line with what you guys are saying. The UWSA has helped with, you know, the petition and, you know, having that rally that happened at lunch hour. So how is that coalition working out? And are the UWSA and the UWFA, Faculty Association and Students Association, are they on your side enough, or do you think they're sort of holding back a bit?
Well, I don't know. We don't want to be kind of lumped in with them. It's a students' movement. It's not the UWSA movement or the Faculty Association movement. It's something that we've done. So I think for that reason, we've kind of remained separate from the other two groups.
And the support that we've gotten from all the different organizations and the UWSA, it's been great. And even from the other students that we've had conversations with face-to-face, we've collected over 2,600 signatures on a petition. That's 2,600 students that we've had face-to-face interactions with. And the support has just been phenomenal. And it's just been great to see everybody come together and work in solidarity.
Have professors in the departments that are being affected sort of join you guys and, like, come out to meetings and things like that?
Not to meetings so far, no. No, I think that's something that's still remained the students' collective, or the student collective, yeah.
Okay, so it's sort of like you guys are drawing a line sort of consciously.
Mm-hmm.
Is it in any way about a fear that jobs could be affected if they are seen to be, you know, being political in the context of their work?
I don't think so. I think it's just we don't want it to seem like it's the professors that are egging the students on and that they're the ones kind of behind it, because they're not. This is something that was completely founded by students, and it's something that's organized and run, and on all aspects it's really a student movement.
And professors have been doing their own things and offering in-kind support and mm-hmm. advice.
But yeah, we're not their pawns to save their jobs. That's not the idea at all.
And really, it's the quality of education that these professors have provided us over the past few years that has really fueled our desire to take a stance against these cuts. I mean, if it wasn't for these professors, I mean, a lot of our lives would be very different.
Yeah.
So I think that's what really drives a lot of passion behind the student movement. And Although they may not be involved directly in this, but you know, they are the reason that we are here today because of, you know, what we have learned from them.
Great. So what has the communication been like with the administration? Because obviously you're making demands of the administration. Has it been, you know, have they been sort of welcome to hear your comments and concerns? Have they sort of shut you guys down? Is it, you know, is there a lot of animosity between you guys and the administration? Just how's that relationship borne out?
Well, they haven't ignored us. We've gotten meetings with them, and yeah, they sure haven't ignored us. I don't know if we'd say we're buddy-buddy with them, but I don't think there's any sort of animosity, really. But, I mean, I can't speak for the whole, for all the administration, all the students, and how everybody feels, but so far it's been, yeah, they haven't ignored us, at least.
We've definitely had our voices heard.
Yeah.
You've made yourselves impossible to ignore in a certain sense, which has been important.
So has that communication borne any fruit? Have they offered anything in the way of concessions or you know, the willingness to negotiate terms of how this whole thing is going to work?
The major change really has been in the words that they've used. They've sort of changed their language into, before it was that this was a cut that was going to happen, it was inevitable, to sort of, you know, now that nothing is final, and now, you know, maybe some things could change. So it's really a change in the tone of the administration is really what we have noticed.
Yeah.
All right. So what I mentioned before, the rally and the petition, have there any been any other specific actions that have taken place since this thing has began?
Well, so far we had the rally, which was great. We had about a couple hundred students come out to that. We had a march to Lloyd Axworthy's office, which was awesome.
Inside the building.
Inside the building.
That was really rad.
Some students started slipping
all our signs,
signs under his door. I mean, it was pretty cool. Global News was there. And yeah, we've got our word out in the media, so the public is aware of this. And we've got the petition. In terms of other things, sort of our group is sort of hasn't really planned anything yet, or we're still in the discussion phases.
Yeah.
It's early on, and I think what we've accomplished so far is getting everybody's attention, and I think that's the first step and the most important step.
Yeah, your petition has been really ongoing mobilization too, because you've made, as you said before, you've made a lot of contact with students.
Great. All right. So I think we're going to take a break. If you're ready, Ethan, that was sort of the first half where I wanted to get, you know, the details of what's going on. In the second half, we might get a little more sort of hypothetical and theoretical about what you guys would want to see sort of at your ideal university is the sort of angle that I want, that I hope to take.
Just go to your school now. Just know that your color is fine. is it important to look at the student strike from, I guess, not only a non-student perspective, but just a social movement perspective in general here?
Well, the demand for getting rid of the tuition hikes is a very specific demand to students, but it's a microcosm of a broader battle against neoliberalism. If you look at the message, the placards, the signs, what people were saying during the large demonstration on March 22nd, it wasn't simply, we want lower tuition and get rid of this hike. It wasn't simply also free tuition. It was a broader fight back against neoliberalism. People who are 25 or under have basically lived under neoliberalism, basically lived under this agenda of privatization, of service fees, of basically user pay. And, you know, might not be familiar with this whole battle that took place in the 60s and 70s and 80s against the entrenchment of neoliberalism. I'm sort of one of the people, Philippe, as well, that come from the generation of Quebec City 2001, which was a battle against neoliberalism, which was a battle against privatization. So for many of the community groups that are supporting the students, that are participating in the demonstrations, that are lending tangible solidarity, we see this not simply as incidental to the struggles that we engage in day to day, but as something that is part and parcel of the battles that we've been fighting for a decade and that some groups have been fighting for many decades. So it's really not too difficult to come out in solidarity and tangibly support the week of economic disruptions. Also, I think it's worth mentioning that there's an element of being inspired here. I mean, it's not every day that you have 200,000 to 300,000 people take the streets. It's not every day that there is a public call for economic disruptions. And this escalation of tactics, I mean, we're in the midst of a very crucial moment in the strike, because it's clear, and CLASS has laid it out very clearly in their communiques. There's a clear strategy here, which is that there have been petitions, people have asked nicely, there's been a mega demonstration, there's been everything that you're supposed to do in a so-called civil society to try to change the mind of a government. So the only thing that's going to work now is economic disruption. And it's easy to say, but it's actually quite a radical tactic. There's quite a bit of repercussions involved. And so I think it's important for community groups to come out and support those groups that are engaging in economic disruptions. The space has also opened up during strikes for broader discussions. And that's one thing we've pointed out in the statement that was released by, it's now been signed by approximately 24 community groups. The space opened up to talk about Plan Nord, to talk about non-status folks, to talk about neoliberalism more in general, to talk about the kind of society that we want. These democratic spaces are opening up within the student movement, but they provide a model for it to open up more broadly. So these are all reasons why it's actually quite easy to come out and say we're going to support the students. And also we have a role to play in the struggle more broadly against capitalism and against neoliberalism.
All right, so that was a clip from CQUT out of Montreal, and that was Jakey Singh talking about the importance of student movements in the fight against neoliberalism. So, of course, what's going on in Quebec right now is very different from what's going on at the U of W. They have, like he said, 300,000 students striking and showing up in mega demonstrations in the street, and I think there was like 200 students at the lunch hour demonstration. Not to undercut that at all, you know, for the U of W, I've been here for, you know, my whole undergrad, and I know how apathetic the student population can be, and 200 students is an accomplishment for sure. But Bronwyn, you mentioned to me that you were involved in the Quebec student strike in 2005 mm-hmm. in Quebec while you were at McGill. Mm-hmm. And so just it might be interesting for people to hear a little bit about how that went, because people might be less aware. They might know right. what's going on in Quebec right now, but right. maybe you can give a little history of what's recently been going on in Quebec in the past couple years.
Right. So my first year at McGill was when there was the last strike before the one that's happening now in 2005. And both the one in 2005 and the one happening now are part of a really long history of striking in Quebec. Student strikes in response to all sorts of different, not just tuition hikes, but cuts to loans and bursaries was the issue when I was there. In the past, it's been, you know, policies that exclude Francophone students from universities, like all sorts of, you know, towards UQAM, the Quebec, University of Quebec at Montreal system, Francophone university students went on strike in order to achieve that. So, yeah, Quebec has this really long history of striking, and it was really interesting to be there because the the ideas that students had, their sense of possibility in relation to what a strike could achieve and what student power could look like was very different than anything I had experienced here. At McGill, less so than when talking to students who didn't go to McGill, because McGill is known for not going on strike when the rest of Quebec does. But so in a sense, what's happening here is different because we don't have this long history of strikes in Winnipeg. But that's the response. What's happening to the universities is part of the same project, right? So the restructuring of universities that's happening, of the university system in Quebec, is part of the same project as what's happening in Winnipeg, at the University of Winnipeg right now. I think that we can't expect Winnipeg students to respond in the same way. Like, in Quebec, people's parents participated in strikes, their older brothers and sisters. There's a really big, there's a tradition, a cultural tradition almost, of responding in that way. And I think that the type of action that's being taken now at the University of Winnipeg is taking some important steps toward building toward that kind of culture. Like, the victories that will be gained here and the momentum that's being built is really important in getting ideas in people's heads about the power of student organizing.
And it's interesting in Quebec, because a lot of the story about the current actions is how much tuition is going to go up. But if you look at the numbers,
it's very low.
Tuition is only like $2,200 per year there right now. So this history of striking, maybe it's an effective right. tactic. Maybe, you know,
tuition is low because they strike.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they take very, you know, very radical, as Jaggi was saying, the strikes don't, like, Quebec students are incredibly sophisticated. They do participate in negotiations and lobbying, etc. Strikes come after that, and economic disruptions and direct action come after that. There's a real sense of escalation of tactics, which is, you know, requires a really strong movement. And it's something, you know, we can think about, hopefully, for the future of Winnipeg. But it's also important to look at kind of where we're at now.
For sure. So Rack and John, as you know, members of the movement here at the University of Winnipeg, can you talk a little bit about how you guys are working in solidarity with those students in Quebec? For example, I know that you've encouraged people to wear red when they come out to rallies and things like that, as they are doing in Quebec. So is there any communication between you guys and people in Quebec about tactics and stuff like that?
No, there hasn't been so far, to my knowledge, anyway.
Not at the moment. We haven't had any communication with anybody in Quebec. But we have, yeah. Like you said, we encourage everybody to wear red to the rally. She mentioned, it's culture in Quebec is a little bit different than it is here, and this is sort of the beginning of what we would like to sort of see for the future, the future culture of the University of Winnipeg. We'd like to see it sort of, you know, take steps towards that in the future, and we'd like to foster that sort of direct action on behalf of the students. And like you said, the students here can be very apathetic, and the fact that we did have 200 people was amazing. Mm-hmm. And we're just sort of, you know, we're starting this sociology collective, and we really want to keep this momentum going into the future so that those kinds of actions in the future can happen, and we can have an environment where those kinds of actions can be successful.
Yeah. And I would say for the mass majority of the students that are involved in this collective and in this action right now, it's really a lot of our first times doing this kind of thing. So, I mean, right now there's a lot of students that part of the collective that may not be comfortable with certain forms of action. So we need to keep all that in mind, that we don't want to have dividing practices and have people criticizing each other's, like, what we're comfortable with doing, some being more radical, some being less. Like, it's important that we accept all these different forms of action, and maybe eventually we can work towards more something like what Quebec has right now. I mean, yeah, I think for a large percentage of us, that would definitely be the goal.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you guys have like a sense of diversity of tactics, even if you don't use that term. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
There needs to be also, like, people don't know about what's happening in Quebec here. There needs to be more knowledge about that, more talking about it.
And with the red, immediately to me, it conjures, you know, concepts of socialism and communism. And I think that might be some of the reasons why people are wearing red in Quebec. Is that something that you guys are conscious of at the U of W as part of your work, that it's socialist ideals that you guys are working towards?
I don't think that's what the red square means.
No?
In Quebec, is it?
Well, I know there's a lot of anarchists and more radical folks working on the ground floor, like sort of directing what's going on a little bit more behind the scenes, and I think that might be a bit of influence there. But maybe, okay, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I don't actually know where the symbolism comes from. I just know a lot of people who wear a red square who wouldn't call themselves socialists.
They might not call themselves that, but yeah. I mean, red is
right,
universally in social movements and social uprisings.
It's the color of generally associated with communism and sort of communist ideologies.
Yeah.
But I think what we're working here towards is more of like collective solutions to these problems. Maybe not necessarily towards a sort of some sort of socialist agenda, but rather we are trying to empower the students to come together as a collective and show solidarity with each other, with our students across the nation. And not necessarily sort of, you know, there's no ideological backdrop to this sort of struggle.
No, and I'm sure a lot of us do have our own ideologies, and they may all very well be different. Like, there may be some who subscribe to a socialist or anarchist or whatever other form of ideology, and there may be some who are more, you know, democratic or, you know, subscribe more to the dominant ideology, and that's neither here nor there. That's just, right now, we are focusing on getting everybody less apathetic, getting everybody who's in the center, who, you know, who's neutral on these topics, to get them more towards, you know, towards left, towards our side, to become more critical. That's the goal right now.
And part of that is having these rallies and these events. Like, the being part of the strikes in 2005 was an incredibly formative experience for me. Just being there is so exciting. And being part of, like, being at that rally, I think, was really exciting for a lot of students who had never been part of rallies before. Like, drawing them in with those kind of public events is very important.
It was my first student rally that I've ever been to. And
did you find it exciting?
It was amazing. I mean,
awesome.
I couldn't stop smiling afterwards. It was so exciting to hear, like, everybody shouting and the echoes of the students in the hallways. I mean, it was just amazing, and I think we'd like to see a lot more of that.
Is it fundamentally different from the sort of ritualized protest that happens every year at the U of W through the Canadian Federation of Students with the, you know, tuition freeze or reduced tuition rallies that happen? It sounds like there's something in it that made you come out to it, that you've never been to any of those other rallies before.
I felt a sense of passion in the students. I felt like everybody that was there was, you know, essentially passionate about it. I mean, just reading all the signs that people brought to the rally, people were genuinely angry at what was happening, and they were genuinely concerned about the quality of their education. And that passion is, to me, it was very inspiring to see that.
We touched on it a little bit before about, you know, tuition costs and how that might shut people out and sort of gets to the classism of university, and that you're charged a fee in order to acquire the knowledge that you can get at universities. So, you know, many would say that that's a fundamental flaw with how universities are. And clearly you guys would be interested in addressing some of those concerns. And I wonder if you could, all three of you, sort of speak broadly and hypothetically, just personally, not related to this movement at all, but just personally, what you would like to see in an ideal university. Like, what would your greatest aspirations for the University of Winnipeg and universities across Canada to look like?
Well, part of what a really cool part of the strike, which Jaggi Singh also said in his quote, strikes take university spaces and make them into spaces that are controlled by students, often when there's occupations, which there have been in Montreal. I envision free tuition, obviously, buildings that are run by students for students. It's very difficult to even imagine what that looks like. But yeah, basically forms of knowledge production and creation that are, I don't know, totally different, that don't make people feel bad and dumb.
I mean, I think to like move towards whatever you would consider to be your ideal university, you would need some broad structural changes in society in general. But of course, ideally, we would like to have university accessible to everybody, regardless of your class or wherever you come from. That the door should be open. If you want to pursue a higher education, you should have that freedom. But again, you can't disconnect it from the broader social issues that, you know, society as a whole faces. And without addressing those, you can't really work towards, you know, any sort of utopian vision you may have of the university. But like you said, tuition is a huge thing, and I think that prevents a lot of people from coming into the university and wanting to pursue an education. I mean, only 5% of the general population goes to university, so we're a minority amongst society, you know, the way that we think. And sort of as sociology students, we're very critical of a lot of things, but at the same time, when you go out there in the real world, you realize that not a lot of people understand these issues the same way that you do, and it sort of isolates you. And it would be nice, you know, if everybody was able to have that freedom that, you know, you're not sort of bound to this wage labor to have to, you know, you can't afford to go to university, you don't have the time, you know, whatever your reasons may be that you can't attend university, to have that opportunity available for you so you can be a more informed, more critical thinking citizen.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that covers it pretty well, and unfortunately we're sort of moving in the other direction with neoliberalism, where it is a corporatization of the university, and we're getting further and further away from having it accessible to everybody. And like Rack said, 5% of the population. I mean, that's really desperately low, and it sort of puts the academics then as sort of elites. We're sort of the people sitting in the ivory tower, and it makes it hard for people who don't attend university to kind of connect to what we're doing. So, yeah, moving towards a more sort of equitable distribution of wealth, where everybody can afford to go to university, and we're not kind of considered the liberal elites who don't connect with the common person.
All right, so yeah, so it sounds like you guys have good aspirational ideas. I like that. But I want to bring up, because a lot of radicals, and myself included, whenever we think, or whenever I think about these sorts of actions and campaigns, we think, okay, is this reformist in a sense that we're changing some sort of surface level stuff and preserving the rotten core, and that we're actually helping the institution in the long run and helping it maintain its sort of structural inequality and things like that? Or is it reform that's not reform, in that it actually helps make fundamental change by making these surface reforms? Do you guys have any thoughts on that as it relates to this campaign?
Well, I would certainly hope that it's the latter of those, that we're making steps in the direction of having it become something more radical, something more critical, something that doesn't sort of support the dominant ideology and support the administration in these cuts. We want to move, this is our action right now. And I can, again, this is purely my personal perspective. I can't speak for the collective, but I mean, this is nowhere near where I want to finish with it. We'd like to go a lot further and fundamentally change things and really more critically address the problems, not just, you know, our immediate concerns.
It's so new right now, too. Like, this has all come together in the past, what, few weeks?
Yeah, 2 weeks.
And the university has thrown this at students in the busiest time of the year. And the amount of consciousness raising that's happened even in 2 weeks has been enormous. So I think that it would be premature to talk about whether or not this is reformist in that way yet, maybe.
But something to keep in mind as
definitely,
as it goes
and it seems like people have that in mind.
Yeah. Great. So that's about it for my questions, guys. You've been great guests, and I think this interview has probably been really, really informative to people who maybe didn't know so much about it before and didn't know the arguments. If Ethan is ready, we're going to finish off the show with a real classic. This is Billy Bragg with Power in a Union. I thought it was sort of appropriate,
yes.
You know, talking about, you know, there's all these unions at the university and what do they really do? And students, you know, are maybe weak individually, but together there's power there.
Together.